Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Can you believe I've had my heater on for 2 days? After just complaining about the heat recently, what was that? Must have only been a few days ago. Now I've got my heater on. Bloody Melbourne weather, I tell you what, can't make up its mind. Anyway, I'm not here to complain about the weather today. I'm here to talk about part four, chapter four, with all of you lovely folk. And I'll just log in order to do that. Part 4, Chapter 4. What do you think of their custody argument? And why does Anna want to be so dead? Those were my questions. Swim said the mama fish. She said, my sister practiced family law as an attorney, which meant she dealt with a lot of child custody cases arising from divorce actions. Based on her anecdotes, so many times the children were just pawns in the enmity, it's a good word, in the enmity of the adults felt towards each other. Their children's welfare was never a consideration. Enmity. Enmity.
Enmity.
A state of feeling, a state or feeling of active opposition or hostility. It means to be enemies. Karenin proclaims he does not love his son but will take him from Anna just because he can to punish her. I think less of Karenin. Do you think less of Karenin? Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty awful thing to do, right? It is a pretty awful thing to do, I'll give you that. But is it really what he's doing, or is that just part of the punishment of her? Like, I don't think he dislikes his kid. I think it's just really hurtful to someone to think that their kid is going to be with someone who dislikes them. So not only is he taking the child from Anna, but is leading her to believe that the child's well-being is in jeopardy, therefore making his move even more painful. It's the most pain he can extract from that move. Now, yeah, even with that in mind, I mean, not to say that's what he's doing. Maybe he just doesn't feel anything for his kid. Either way, it's a shitty thing to do. But I suspect, is that what he's doing? Is he just trying to make it as painful for Anna as he can now? Or is he being genuine that he does not love his son? Really, it's probably the latter. I'm probably just giving the character more depth than Tolstoy gave him. Maybe I'm really drilling into these characters. Either way, yeah, he's becoming quite vicious and quite, what's the word I'm looking for? Cruel. In his pursuit of revenge. Question 2, why does Anna want to be so dead? Swim said, well, she is currently trapped in a terrible marriage with a guy who threatens to take away her son, and he also tells her he doesn't love. She can't initiate divorce and would have to leave her son per law at that time. She's pregnant with her lover's baby and stuck at home and probably doesn't get to see much of him while he gets to go gallivanting around showing off his prowess. She feels fat and ugly. Right now, she is in the grips of believing that everyone would be better off if she were dead. I imagine she's thinking Karenin would love his son again, Vronsky would be able to go off and live a happier life, and her to-be-born baby wouldn't be saddled with a bad mother such as herself. Wow. Yeah, I think you're probably right. The poor thing, it makes me feel really bad for her when you say all that. I mean, I don't really like any of these characters, you know? Like, I don't really feel like anyone is a good person in this book. But I do really feel bad for her there. I mean, I suppose if she's been in a marriage which has been this unhappy for this long and you're stuck in it as per the day, you know, you couldn't just get a divorce if you didn't love your husband anymore, kind of thing. Yeah, that's a tough thing. Sluggy with 3G said, I think you nailed it in both parts. Anna feels trapped now, and I think she sees her death as the only way out for everyone involved. It was heartbreaking when she finally, desperately, reveals to Karenin that she is pregnant, and he responds by snatching his hand away from her and leaving. Simply Productive said, I love your comments. They are so insightful. I totally agree with you. It definitely seems like this is about as far away as they've been so far. not on the same page, and not willing to reconcile. I Am Norwegian said, I'm surprised Alexei actually did something for once. Taking the kid out of spite is obviously cruel, but I think Anna is going to respect him more going forwards. Anyways, early in her unfaithfulness, she thought little of Alexei, walking around oblivious as he was. At one point, she even thought she would have had more respect for him if he just killed her instead. Anna can't see a way out of her predicament. She can't let go of Vronsky. She can't lose custody of her child, so she's stuck between a rock and a hard place, hoping just to be crushed instead of having to choose. Add a lot of guilt to the mixture, and you have a nice little I-should-just-die cocktail. Simply Productive said, absolutely. The child, I'm sure, would hate being stuck with Alexei, given his ill temperament. And that poor, poor child. It's the first thing about this book that has made me viscerally feel anything. The predicament of the child with Alexei the whole time has been tugging on my heartstrings, but a small part of me bitterly thinks that Anna would be even worse for the child because she herself is still a selfish brat. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to feel much in this book for these characters, other than for the child, you know, who's the victim here of all these idiot adults. Nifty-rific. I really enjoy Karenin's chapters. Anna describes her husband one way, as unfeeling, a machine. Society respects him and considers him a great man and a wise decision maker. But we read about this sort of mess of a person that is so hurt and angry, his actions are in sort of contrast to his level-headed persona. Karenin, dressing with haste as though he was carrying a cup brimful of wrath, how great is that description, and stumbling over his words while making a pretty valid point, she thinks he is an unfeeling machine, but he has been deeply hurt by her actions, and it is unfortunate that his reaction is to be vindictive instead of just letting her go and moving on with his life and being supportive of Sirza. We occasionally talk about why Hemingway chose the book, the books he did for this list, and the humanity and depth of Tolstoy's characters is just amazing. I enjoy the tidbits of the podcast where Anna mentions it, like how Tolstoy can describe these characters, even their physical attributes, in the descriptions of their actions. Karenin finds out she's pregnant, flushes, and leaves. It says so much. Thanks for the compliment. And that is one of the things I enjoy most about Tolstoy, is how quickly he can give a character so much depth. And he's subtle about it too, like, we're here, you know, I've been on this journey with these characters and saying, not long ago I was saying, you know, I don't feel much for these characters. I don't have that clear a picture of them. And now I'm sitting here thinking about how unlikable they are, but with a really good sense of depth about those characters. He sneaks them up on you in a way. I think maybe the same in War and Peace. In some cases, he'll introduce a character and within one page, you know that person in such a deep way, right? And then for the next few hundred pages, that person evolves and changes in such a real way that they feel not real once, but real across a time scape, you know? Like they've evolved as a real person would evolve. Multi-dimensional. Sorry, I'm drinking some water because my throat is, as you can probably hear, quite dry. I am enjoying these chapters more than the farming chapters, I'll give you that much. I was ready to move on from the farming chapters. They were cool. And I feel like when I reflect back on the book in the future, those chapters will be one of the highlights of the book. But I was ready to I don't know, just give me some good old-fashioned gossip again, you know? He said, she said, will they, won't they? I'm a sucker for it. Simply Productive said, I hope I'm not too late to share about my hometown. I utterly forgot and then remembered suddenly in a dream. Yes, I'm dreaming about the podcast. No need to read the comment on the podcast, but I will explain below for those interested. I kind of want to read this, because I love talking about the people of this community as much as I enjoy the book we read. So you've said, no need to read the comment. But I think I'm going to, and I hope you don't mind that I do. I hope that wasn't your subtle way of saying, please don't read the comment. You might have just been being polite, but I actually genuinely want to, so I hope that's okay. So here we go. My hometown is Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada. Andrew, if you Google this to find pictures, please Google Alberta landscapes, because Edmonton just comes up with an absolutely hideous cityscapes. Oh, yeah. I'm going to look that up. Oh, my God. Look at those landscapes. This looks a lot like where I Am Norwegian was from. Different trees, different foliage, but with those rocky, snowy peaks and those lakes. Absolutely stunning. Oh, and farmscape there. Wow. Does everyone just live in, like, relative heaven? And I'm going to, even though you said not to, I want to look at Edmonton to see what this ugly town of yours looks like. Oh, that's not ugly. No, it's got a nice river bend and some bridges and some triangular buildings. That's not ugly at all. That's a good looking city. I mean, you know, it is a absolutely amazing landscape. There's nothing wrong with that city. If you look up my hometown, that's an ugly town. See, when I told you where I live, the Yarra Valley, I said the Yarra Valley because that's like wine country, but I live in a little town which is kind of, they call it like the gateway to the Yarra Valley. Sits on the doorstep of it. Technically, it's part of it, but it's just a very mundane little town, Lilydale. And if you looked up that, you would see an ugly little town with a pretty inconsistent and ugly suburban setting. Yeah, that's what you'd see. That is what you'd see. Oh, man. Yeah, no, that's ugly. I'm looking at it right now. Okay. Anyway, to continue with this comment. Thanks, Edmonton. Oh, thanks. Edmonton is the capital of the province, but it is about equal size to Calgary, A, B. We are known as the blue-collar city, where Calgary is white-collar. A few interesting facts about this. I live a few hours away from the Rocky Mountains and from Lake Louise and Banff and Jasper, which are all world-renowned destinations. Alberta is what you could call a blue state, the equivalent of Canada's Bible Belt, but only once you leave the city. We're called the Texas of Canada by the locals, with a negative connotation. Sorry to any Texans in here. We do like y'all. That said, Edmonton and Calgary are very progressive. Temperature here is averaging at, I would say, 0 to 10 degrees for the most part. It is unusual to hit 30 degrees Celsius, but is normal to hit negative 17. Last winter we hit negative 40 on a constant basis, and it was the first time I've seen us be phased by the winter because the starter batteries were freezing solid in people's cars. Wow. I'm wondering what the temperature is like for I Am Norwegian. We are also known for bright blue skies and are one of the best areas to place solar panels, except for the issues of snow. We get some of the most clear days on the planet. When it isn't a beautiful blue sky day, it is unusual and puts a damper on the spirits. I hated London when I went because I felt like I was in a movie of sad people, and it took me ages to realize it was the sky. Isn't that funny? An overcast sky is such a mood suppressant. On an overcast day, a dull day, everyone just feels flat. It really makes a difference. To be able to see the blue sky makes your spirits so much higher, even if it is freezing. Edmonton is called the City of Champions and the City of Festivals. My favourite festival is the the Byzantine Festival on 118 Avenue. We have axe throwing, mulled apple cider, stilt walkers, and local bands at a measly negative 20 degree temp, sometimes in December each year. For the average tourist, you can come to West Edmonton Mall, which according to Wikipedia is the largest mall in North America, covering about 5.3 million square feet and over 24,000 employees, and it currently holds records for largest indoor amusement park, largest indoor roller coaster, largest indoor lake, largest indoor water park, largest parking lot. But for the love of God, if you come to Edmonton, never visit West Edmonton Mall. That place is hell on earth. You can walk for days without finding what you're looking for. It has two mini golf courses, a movie theater, a literal ship in the middle of the lake, an ice skating rink. It's hell. You don't want to go. You'll never get out. There are over 50 main exits, and you'll still never get out. Instead, go to the River Valley. The River Valley is the largest urban park in Canada. It covers 160 kilometers of maintained pathways and is 22 times larger than Central Park, and it is beautiful, especially in the fall. That is my little rant about the awesome, my awesome hometown. If any of you visit, hit me up. I'll be your tour guide and help you find a great accommodation. But really, if you come to Canada, just go to Banff, Jasper, or go to the West Coast. That's the pretty part. Edmonton is fantastic, but not for a vacation. Vacation, I should say. It's a place to live, not visit. Wow, I really want to go there now. That mall, as much as you said it was awful, sounds awesome. And so does that park. I hope I don't have to choose between them. If I ever go there, I'll go to both of those places and maybe just get lost for a day in each, you know, 2 days. I'll spare a day for each of those of pure just lost wandering. That sounds really fun. I Am Norwegian said, Hastad is in a sort of natural valley with mountains everywhere to prevent high winds, so it rarely gets below negative 10 degrees Celsius. The Byzantine Festival sounds fun. I've never seen axe throwing off of Reddit. The West Edmonton Mall sounds like my personal nightmare, though. Oh, come on, guys. Where's your sense of adventure? I think if you had a pocket full of cash so that you could just be like, oh, cool, an indoor roller coaster. Let's go on it. Oh, look at that. Mini golf. Let's have a go. It could be really fun. Although, if you didn't have a pocket full of cash, that would be the worst place in the world. Just walking around looking at things that you cannot participate in. Whereas the park, any old whim, you can follow up. You know, the entrance cost is like a pocket full of breadcrumbs, so you can feed the ducks. Your hometown, says Simply Productive, sounds like the kind of place I would go for vacation, to be honest. It looks absolutely beautiful and it seems to have nice architecture. Negative 10 is a good temperature. That's practically sweater weather. Do you have any festivals or the like over there? Ooh, festivals. I'm Norwegian says we have one music festival a year. We also get old car shows and motorcycle meetups. It's a very culturally active town, or so I've heard. I've always been too good at keeping myself busy with solitary hobbies, so I have no real idea about anything except the big events that you can't help but notice. You guys, I want to go to both of your towns, so get the couch ready. I'll be couch surfing your way. Or at least hook me up with somewhere good. A good Airbnb. Water. One day I'll go to a travel agent and I'll have a random list of destinations and they'll say, what is this list? And I'll say, that's the Hemingway list of travel destinations. And they'll think, oh, what's this Hemingway list of travel destinations? Is this all the place Hemingway went? But it'll just be all the places where the listeners of this podcast and the members of this community are from. And it'll be my bucket list to go to them all. One day, that's what will happen. Simply Productive said, Ander, if you're serious about a jingle, you've got lots of musicians in the group. Yourself, I Am Norwegian, and myself, for sure. And I'm confident others. I wrote the podcast jingle for my mum's work. Congratulations on being an uncle again. Being an aunt, uncle is the best. I love spoiling kids a bit. Take them someplace special and have their favourite foods and all that. I hope you enjoy that as well. Absolutely, I do enjoy that. When we went to the hospital, it was me and my mum took my niece. And she'd already met her little sister. She'd already been, but we were taking her again to go and see her little sister in the hospital for a second time. And so my niece, the older one, she's 3.5. And so we went up there, and then it was a bit hard to get her to sit still. So Mum took her down to the playground outside the hospital. And then once my visit was sort of finished, you know, I went down and met them in the playground. And then Mum said, "Is it okay if I sneak up again for one more cuddle?" I said, "Yeah, go on." So then I looked after my niece in the playground. And just for probably 15 minutes. And it was just so nice, you know. Like, that's what I love doing, that, because we were just going on the swing and going down the slide and, you know, making a pretend shop in the playground and selling each other pretend chips. But then I kept asking her things about her little sister and asking, you know, what's it like being a big sister and what's your favorite bit about being a sister and all these things. And it was just really fun to, like, how much of a, like, it was the big thing in her life at that moment was being a sister. And, and, you know, still it will be the big thing in her life. But I don't know. That was really nice. I really enjoyed that. About the jingle, yeah. Hey, I would love a jingle. I would love to have some jingles. To have some jingles, you know, to choose a jingle. I have a jingle that I discovered years ago. It was from a kind of a mock song that my brother made, but I really loved this bit of this mock song, which I thought was so cool. And it was like the hypiest bit of music you've ever heard, like hype. And I love it. And I've always like, one day I'll make that the intro to a podcast. But then with this one, I'm like, it clearly doesn't suit this podcast because it's like hype to the max. But that could be really funny to have like the hypiest jingle and then be like, "Welcome to a podcast about old literature." So maybe, you know what? I'll do that. Tomorrow's episode, I'll hit you with the jingle. But that's by no means going to be the jingle of the podcast. I'm just going to chuck it out there as my contribution. If anyone feels like chucking a jingle together, I'm all ears. I'm tempted to say we'll have some kind of jingle competition, but I think every podcast that's ever been created has had a jingle competition. So let's just listen to some jingles. Oh my God, I'm waffling on tonight. I just realized how long I've been talking for. This is like the longest podcast in ages. Simply Productive said, "You have a national holiday for horse racing." It's actually a state holiday. It's not around the whole country. It's just in Victoria. But yeah, we do. Our next holiday will be Remembrance Day for all previous wars. Right now, we wear pins of poppies to remember after the poem, "In Flanders Fields, in Flanders Fields, the poppies grow between the crosses row on row." The like that always chills me, the line that always chills me the most is, "We are the dead, short days ago we lived, felt dawn, watched sunset glow, loved and were loved, but now we lie in Flanders Fields." And now I'm wondering if this poem is known around the world. It's so common in Canada that most of us know it better than the words to our national anthem. I've heard of it. I don't know if I've ever read it. Flanders Fields is very familiar. I didn't know that's where the poppy thing came from. But we use poppy here as a symbol of remembrance. We have Remembrance Day here as well. I wonder if it's on the same day. Probably is. We also have Anzac Day, which is a national holiday to commemorate and remember our Anzacs, which is a beautiful thing. And poppies, we use poppies for that as well. Why is the poppy the symbol of remembrance? I'd love to know. There's probably some really poignant reason. I'm wondering what will happen next to Anna's reputation, says Simply Productive. I'm willing to bet, especially because of that baby bump, that she's going to become heavily ostracized by her closest group, and that nothing bad will happen to Vronsky directly, but that he will feel a lot of pressure on his job front. I feel awful for the poor child. It is a moral obligation when you have a child to bring them up as best you can, and to use the child as a pawn is disgusting and awful, but will continue to happen. I love what Swim added about her experience, because it just reminds you that things don't ever really change. People still cheat and still use their children as a bargaining chip. I wonder what will happen once the baby bump is too big to hide. will that be when the outrage really begins? Yeah, I can see why there's so much spite around the question of who gets the baby. Like, you could argue that Anna is the one that caused there to be the question of who will be the predominant parent. And so in some ways you could argue it's her fault that the question has arisen at all. And in that case you could say, well, it's kind of fair that Karenin is bitter about that. Like, because of what you've done, we now have to decide which one of us gets the child, and which is just an unfair thing to have to do at all, and that's on you. And therefore, why shouldn't it be me that gets the child? You know? Like, you're the one shitty enough to cause this problem, so therefore, you're not fit. Like, why should you then also be default the one that gets to walk away with the object of both of our affection? So I can see it in that way, but then I can also see that she loves the child and he's claimed not to, so then by default it should be under her care. Tricky. Is it tricky or is it black and white? I don't know. I think it's bad though that the poor child has to have one parent rather than two in some ways. Okay, anyway, chapter 5. Let's read chapter 5. It's getting late. The famous Petersburg lawyer's waiting room was full when Karenin entered it. Three women, an old lady, a young lady, and a tradesman's wife, and three gentlemen, one a German banker with a ring on his finger, another a bearded merchant, and a third an irate official in uniform with an order hanging from his neck, had evidently long been waiting. Two clerks sat at their tables writing, and the sound of their pens was audible. The writing table accessories, of which Karenin was a connoisseur, were unusually good, as he could not help noticing. One of the clerks, without rising from his chair, screwed up his eyes and addressed Karenin ill-humouredly. "What do you want?" "I want to see the lawyer on business." "The lawyer is engaged," replied the assistant sternly, and indicated with his pen the persons who were waiting. "Can he not find time to see me?" said Karenin. "He has no spare time. He is always busy. Be so kind as to wait." "Then I will trouble you to give him my card," said Karenin with dignity, seeing the impossibility of preserving his incognito. The assistant took the card, and though he evidently did not approve of what he read on it, went out of the room. Karenin approved in theory of public trial, but for certain high official reasons he did not quite sympathize with some aspects of its application in Russia, and he condemned these applications as far as he could condemn anything that had been confirmed by the emperor. His whole life had been spent in administrative activity, and therefore when he disapproved of anything, his disapproval was mitigated by a recognition of the inevitability of mistakes and the possibility of improvement in everything. In the new legal institutions, he disapproved of the position occupied by lawyers, but till now he had never had to deal with a lawyer, and so had disapproved only in theory. Now his disapproval was strengthened by the unpleasant impression he received in the lawyer's waiting room. "He will be here in a moment," said the assistant, and in fact, a minute or two later, in the doorway appeared the long figure of an elderly jurisconsult who had been conferring with the lawyer, followed by the lawyer himself. The lawyer was a short, thick-set, bald-headed man, with a black beard tinged with red, long, light-coloured eyebrows, and a bulging forehead. He was as spruce as a bridegroom. From his white necktie and double watch chain to his patent leather boots, his face was intelligent and peasant-like, but his dress was dandified and in bad taste. "Come in, please," said the lawyer to Karenin, and gloomily ushering his client in before him, he closed the door. "Won't you take a seat?" He pointed to a chair beside a writing table covered with papers, and himself took the principal seat, rubbing his little hands with their short fingers covered with white hair and bending his head to one side. But hardly had he settled down when a moth flew across the table. The lawyer, with a rapidity one could not have expected of him, separated his hands, caught the moth, and resumed his former position. "Before I begin speaking of my case," said Karenin, who had followed the lawyer's movements with astonishment, "I must mention that the business about which I have to speak to you must be strictly private." A scarcely perceptible smile moved the lawyer's drooping reddish moustache. "I should not be a lawyer if I could not keep the secrets entrusted to me, but if you would like a confirmation..." Karenin glanced at him and saw that his intelligent grey eyes were laughing as if he knew everything in advance. "You know my name," continued Karenin. "I know you, and like every Russian I know..." Here he caught again a moth. "Your useful activity," said the lawyer, bowing. Karenin sighed, collecting his courage, but having once made up his mind, he went on in his squeaky voice, without timidity or hesitation, emphasizing a word here and there. "I have the misfortune," began Karenin, "to be a deceived husband, and I wish legally to break off relations with my wife, that is, to be divorced, but in such a way that my son should not remain with his mother." The lawyer's grey eyes tried not to laugh, but they danced with irrepressible glee, and Karenin saw that it was not only the glee of a man getting profitable business. There was triumphant delight and a gleam resembling the evil budding gleam he had seen in his wife's eyes. "You want my assistance to obtain a divorce?" "Just so. But I must warn you that there is a risk that I may be wasting your time. I have come only for a preliminary consultation. I wish for a divorce, but the form in which it can be obtained is of importance to me. It is quite possible that if the forms do not coincide with my requirements, I shall forego my legitimate desire." "Oh, that is always so," said the lawyer. "That is always open to you." The lawyer looked down at Karenin's feet, feeling that the sight of his irrepressible joy might offend his client. He glanced at a moth that flew past his nose, and his hand moved, but did not catch it, out of respect for Karenin's situation. "Although the general outline of our laws relating to this matter is known to me," continued Karenin, "I should like to know the forms in which such cases are conducted in practice." "You wish me to state," said the lawyer, still not raising his eyes and adopting with a certain pleasure his client's manner of speech, "the various methods by which your desire can be carried out." And on Karenin's nodding affirmatively, the lawyer continued, only occasionally casting a glance at Karenin's face, which had grown red in patches. "Divorce under our laws," he said, with a slight shade of disapproval of the laws, "as you are aware, may be granted in the following cases. You must wait," he exclaimed, addressing his assistant, who had looked in at the door, but he rose all the same, spoke a few words to his assistant, and sat down. "In the following cases: physical defect in the husband or wife, 5 years' absence without news," and he bent one of his short, hairy fingers, "and in cases of adultery," he added the word with evident pleasure, "these are subdivided as follows," and he went on, bending down his thick fingers, causing the cases and the subdivisions evidently could not be classed today together. "Physical defects in husband or in wife, and adultery of the husband or of wife." As all his fingers had been used, he straightened them out, all out, and continued, "That is the theoretical view, but I suppose you have done me the honour of applying to me in order to learn the practical application of the law. Therefore, guided by the precedents, I have to inform you that cases of divorce all come to the following. There is, I suppose, no physical defect or absence without news." Karenin nodded affirmatively. "Come to the following: adultery of the husband or the wife, and the detection of the guilty party by mutual consent, or involuntary detection without such consent. I must add that the latter case is seldom met with in practice." And with a momentary glance at Karenin, the lawyer became suddenly silent, like a man who, when selling pistols, has described the advantages of the different kinds and waits for his customer's decision. But Karenin remained silent, and so he began again. "The most usual, simple, and reasonable way I consider to be adultery by mutual consent. I should not venture so to express myself were I talking to a man of undeveloped mind," said the lawyer, "but I expect it is comprehensible to you." Karenin was, however, so much upset that he did not at once understand the reasonableness of adultery by mutual consent, and his perplexity was expressed in his looks. But the lawyer immediately helped him. "Two people can no longer live together. There is the fact. And if both agree about that, the details and the formalities become unimportant, and at that same time it is the simplest and surest method." Karenin quite understood now, but he had religious requirements which hindered his acceptance of this method. "It is out of the question in the present case," said he. "Only one measure is possible: involuntary detection confirmed by letters which I have." At the mention of letters, the lawyer pressed his lips together and gave vent to a high-pitched sound of pity and contempt. Please remember that cases of this kind, as you know, are decided by the ecclesiastical department, and the reverend fathers in such cases are keenly interested in the minutest details, he said, with a smile that showed his fellow feeling with the reverend father's taste. Letters may certainly serve as a partial confirmation, but direct evidence from witnesses must be produced. In general, if you do me the honour to entrust the case to me, leave me to choose the means which should be used. He who desires a result accepts the means of obtaining it. If it is so, Karenin began, growing suddenly pale, but at that moment the other suddenly rose and went to the door to speak to his assistant, who had again come to interrupt him. "Tell her we have not got a cheap sale on here," he said, and came back again. As he was returning, he furtively caught another moth. "A fine state my furniture will be in when summer comes," he thought, and frowned. "Yes, you were saying," he began. "I will write and let you know what I decide," said Carrington, rising and holding on by the table. After a short pause, he said, "I may conclude from your words that a divorce could be obtained. I would also ask you to let me know your terms. It is quite possible, if you allow me full liberty of action," said the lawyer, without taking any notice of the last question. When may I expect to hear from you?" he added, moving toward the door, his eyes and patent leather boots shining. "In a week's time, and you will be so good as to let me know whether you are willing to undertake the case, and on what terms." "Very well." The lawyer bowed deferentially, let his client pass out, and, being left alone, abandoned himself to his happy mood. He felt so cheerful that, contrary to his custom, he allowed a reduction to the bargaining lady, and gave up catching moths, having made up his mind to have his furniture recovered next winter with velvet, like Sigonin's. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. Have your say on the subreddit. Thanks for listening to a very long episode. I'll catch you tomorrow.